Today is December 2nd, 2006, and this is the Weekly Roundup, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
This week, it's a context explosion. Bits and pieces of news everywhere. Jeff, tell us what happened this week.
Okay. Apple Computer's ongoing legal battle with David Contois is finally over, now that the patent he says Apple stole from him was awarded to the iPod maker in an out-of-court settlement. The patent in question describes how computers manage and download media files to external devices, in essence, exactly what iTunes does.
Michael Starkweather, the attorney that wrote the patent for Mr. Contois, commented, "That's the billion-dollar patent. I believe, he believes, with this patent in hand, Apple will eventually be after every phone company, filmmaker, computer maker, and video producer to pay royalties on every download of not just music, but also movies and video. The terms of Apple's settlement with Mr. Contois, naturally, have not been disclosed."
And speaking of which, there's a new competitor in the digital downloads market that Apple can attack with that patent. The file swapping and download system BitTorrent announced deals with several studios on Wednesday for legal movie and TV show downloads. 20th Century Fox, G4, Katakawa Pictures USA, Lionsgate, Palm Pictures, Paramount Pictures, and Starz Media have all signed on to provide content.
Obligatory remark here, you'll notice that Disney and its subsidiaries are not on that list.
And MTV Networks is also on board. They're providing a pile of TV show content, and BitTorrent's movie and TV show service is expected to launch in February. It'll include music, download-to-own TV programs, on-demand and download rental movies, and video games. Pricing information is not yet available. BitTorrent's announcement came only a day after Walmart said that it is launching its own movie download service.
Our amoral, evil-minded, file-sharing pirate listeners will probably recognize BitTorrent as a less corporate service. We'll talk about that migration in the context machine.
And also this week, Microsoft released Windows Vista for purchase by corporate customers. The consumer release date is scheduled tentatively, at least, for January 30th.
And we'll probably end up comparing Vista and OS X 10.5, or Leopard, the branded name, in a future show. Presumably we'll do that once both are available. And finally this week, it's that time of year when I get to rail against one of the sillier things that tends to come out of Wall Street. I want to talk for a moment about price targets. Ostensibly, these targets, and if you've listened to the show for a while, you may have heard me talk about these on past shows, they're the price at which analysts expect the stock to trade 12 months from today. Now, here's the problem. The targets are very rarely changed, and they rarely correlate to the buy, hold, or sell ratings that analysts place on a stock. Now, for example, if you set a price target at $90 and the actual price of the stock falls to $70, shouldn't you switch your rating if it was previously a hold to a buy? That doesn't necessarily happen. Or, say you hold a buy rating on a stock and the price of the stock rises to within 10% of your target for it. Shouldn't you then change your rating to a sell? After all, the target says you expect the price of the stock to be unchanged a year from today. That doesn't seem like a very good investment. Well, analysts don't always do that either. Now, for a company that's hot at the holiday season, like Apple, this is the time when price targets and stock ratings tend to inflate. And the problem is even worse when it applies to Apple's stock, because Macworld happens just 2 weeks into the year, and the speculation game tends to cause the stock price to jitter around even more. And that happens, it's perturbed by the fact that the analysts now routinely participate in the speculation game as well. Anyway, it's against that backdrop that I give you this little piece of news. Think equity analyst Jonathan Hoops is predicting strong holiday sales for Apple Computer, estimating that Apple will show $1.5 billion in retail store sales alone. That's just retail revenue. On that basis, Mr. Hoops raised his target price for Apple stock from $100 to $110 and is maintaining his buy rating. Now, so why did he still have a buy rating on the stock when the actual price was within 10% of his old target? After all, I believe that the Dow Jones Industrial Average has an average appreciation of more than 10%. All right, kiddies. So it's the season. It's the season for analyst skepticism. I'm sure we'll be talking about it more. Let the games begin. Let's get into the context machine. So, Jeff, I apologize for forcing you to listen to that rant. Let's back up and talk about music downloads, and let's begin with this patent settlement. This patent that Apple has just acquired, it protects music downloading. But this is the thing that I'm curious about. It was it traded hands in an out of court settlement. So someone had a patent. They said, "You are challenging or you're doing something that violates my patent." Apple says, "All right." Well, they come to some agreement. We'll pay you some presumably large sum of money, and you'll give us this patent. End of conflict. Now, presumably, there are any number of reasons why Apple might have done this. Presumably, they want patent protection for stuff that they're doing with iTunes. But has this patent ever been challenged in court? I mean, do we have any reason to believe that this patent is actually useful for going after competitors?
Well, the first time it was tested was when Mr. Contoy and his company went after Apple. And we can see how that turned out. Now it's Apple's patent and not his. So now we have to wait and see what happens if Apple decides to flex their muscles with this patent and go after anyone else that might happen to be creating some type of system that allows you to download media content. And from what I gather, there's one or two other companies out there that are doing that.
One or two.
One or two.
For example, Verizon and Walmart and Microsoft and MTV.
And Amazon.
And so there are these companies all over the place doing this. It does seem difficult to believe that one company, when there's such a wide field for this, Apple didn't even hold the patent that it would be using to protect its iTunes distribution model. It seems hard to believe that they could walk into a federal court and say, "Hey, we have protection for this entire process of downloading music to a client application. So therefore, everyone else who's in this business, whether they're downloading to a cell phone or to a portable music player or to a computer, they all have to pay us royalties or they have to cease and desist." Doesn't that seem extraordinary?
It most certainly does. And, you know, I can't wait to see what happens with this. You can't write drama this good. What we're dealing with now is a situation where Apple, if they were to go after another company, would show up in court, and then immediately the attorneys for the company or individuals they're going after would say, "Well, we don't get it. You're saying this is a valid patent and we owe you money. But when you tried to get the patent, you told everyone this wasn't a valid patent at all. So what the hell?"
And of course, that never reached ruling. Their argument that it's not a valid patent never reached ruling.
Right.
And so who knows? The one other thing that I want to just remind listeners of, if you're curious about an interesting comparison case, go take a look at a show we did several weeks ago now. The name of the show was A Creative Settlement. I think it was sometime in early September. Maybe late August, where we were talking about the settlement between Creative and Apple over Creative's patent for MP3 player interfaces. That, I understand, has been set up in a way that Apple does have some coverage. Now, that was a settlement as well.
Right.
But it seems like a more relevant settlement in the sense that Apple didn't get control of the patent. They just said, "Look, we're going to pay you a flat $100 million. And Creative, you keep the patent, but we now have an unlimited retroactive and future license to use that patent. Go ahead and use our settlement, our acknowledgement of your patent, to go attack everybody else who's making MP3 players." That seems like a much stronger case for Creative to make than for Apple to make with this patent about iTunes distribution.
I agree. Now, what I think may happen with this patent is that Apple is going to use it as a tool to, in some fashion, to remind all of the other media companies, or like movie producers, TV show producers, what they have going, and that it's in their best interest to make sure their content is on the iTunes store. And I'm not saying Apple is going to go in and strong arm anyone and say, we got this patent, see? So you're going to put your movies on our network, see? They're not going to do anything like that. But I think something's going to happen where Apple says, look, we've got this patent, and you know, it would really be in your best financial interest to just go ahead and work with us instead of fight with us. You know what we mean? Wink, wink.
Fair enough. Now, let's talk for a couple minutes about BitTorrent. First of all, can you give us a summary of what BitTorrent is?
Okay, if you look at it from what it's supposed to be and what it was designed as, BitTorrent is a peer-to-peer type file sharing system that distributes the load of sending files to people across several machines instead of having one server that has to dole out massive files all the time. So in theory, you should be able to get files faster, and you have less bandwidth hit and processor hit on the servers that are giving the files, because everyone is participating in this whole process. Now, what came out of that was people went, hey, I can put movies and music online. And that's where the whole problem with BitTorrent happened. So there's always been a legitimate use for BitTorrent. It's just that the whole file sharing thing without proper licensing has overshadowed that.
Now explaining to us how BitTorrent was used for both legitimate and not legitimate purposes. I'm curious, logistically, normally when people think about BitTorrent, they think about file sharing. That is one person right. Sharing their own files. Before we get into the discussion of the business deals that go into this, if BitTorrent were going to distribute files on its own as a content provider, how would they go about doing that?
What they have to do is take control over the legit files that they're distributing. So have their own servers and give everyone their logins for that, so people can go and legitimately purchase and download content. And then they also have to take it a step further and watch the traffic that's going through their systems for people that are sharing files that they shouldn't be, and then shut that part down, which is a lot easier said than done. But they're going to give it a shot.
Now, that reminds me, in some sense, we talked several shows ago about viral video, about viral content in general, and how YouTube and other sites like it are in a position of having to at once encourage user involvement and sort of user ingenuity, and at the same time, they then put themselves out there in a position where people can post or provide copywritten or content that's not their own for other people to steal, and then they have to go and police their own network. So that's essentially, it's the same thing that you're describing, right? In the same way that YouTube needs to purge videos that content owners don't want to have available on YouTube, BitTorrent has to do the same thing.
Right. Now, interesting thing about YouTube is they've been working out deals where they're going to use some of their magic technology they've developed to be able to figure out what's in the content that's being hosted through YouTube, and then be able to pay royalties back to the license holders, which is a very clever way to do this. Now, BitTorrent, it looks like they're just going to kill the content that shouldn't be there.
Fair enough. And that makes sense because, of course, BitTorrent is in a position of trying to sell content rather than provide content and reap revenue from ads.
Right.
All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the business side of this. How would BitTorrent go about doing this? I mean, they are currently let's drop the comparison, for example, with Napster. Napster tried to go legit and has essentially imploded. What's different with the BitTorrent model? What is it? Is it because BitTorrent played their cards right, or because the media companies were more flexible? Also interesting to note that they're making deals with movie studios, not with music providers.
Yeah, BitTorrent, was in the right place at the right time to start doing this, because right now all of the big companies want to have a piece of the movie pie, and the movie industry wants to find more ways to generate revenue. And we have Apple with the iTunes Store, and they have what I still think is the best model and the best implementation. They just don't have all the other studios on board. And I think a lot of these studios want to join Apple. Well, I'm certain they do, but they want Apple to change the licensing that the iTunes Store has. So now they're going to all of these other companies that are willing to implement the draconian licensing that the studios want. And I think what they want to do is distribute themselves out through all these other avenues where they can potentially make some money, but they can also use that as a lever to try and convince Apple to change its licensing. So I think there's a lot of under the table things happening here, bait and switch. It's an exciting game, and I can't wait to see how it plays out.
Now, when you talk about bait and switch, it sounds like you're talking about under the table things happening among the various players in this industry. And one of the things that's so fascinating to me about the setup with movies versus the setup with music several years ago, first of all, we were talking about, or I mentioned Napster. I feel like one of the other distinctions here is that the music industry panicked when they saw Napster. They had no idea how to deal with it, and so the first instinct was, let's shut it down. Which is not happening here. And one of the other things that's so fascinating to me, when you compare the movie situation to the music situation, Apple has clearly far less leverage here than they did with the music studios. They don't have all of the movie studios on board. They have less leverage than they did with TV shows. No one else was selling TV shows. They got ABC or the Disney Channel or the Disney owned channels on the iTunes Music Store, and everybody else fell in line within about 6 months. That is clearly not going on here. Apple has not gotten all the other movie studios to sign on, and there must still be disagreements. So it's fascinating to understand that the movie studios must feel like they're under far less pressure to get on the iTunes Music Store than the TV channels did or than the music labels did. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they really desperately want to have their content on the iTunes Store because that's where it's going to sell the best. But I think that the movie industry has a group of people running that are, they're just greedy. That's the bottom line. We have a bunch of greedy people running that industry, even more so than the music industry. And they've seen how all of the music stuff played out and how that market is evolving, and what they want to do is avoid having their market evolve, which isn't going to work because we have this new distribution system, and this distribution system requires a new way of looking at how you license the content, and that's not something that the movie industry wants to change. So now we're having to deal with this whole thing where they're trying to push their system that they've been using forever down Apple's throat, and Apple saying, look, this is a new game, it has to change, and this is the way it needs to work. And now we just have this deadlock. I think it's all going to get worked out, and I think that it's going to work out more the way Apple wants than the way the movie studios want, because they're going to watch a lot of these services just not work.
I think it's interesting. I mean, when you say push down people's throats, my understanding is that you're talking about, for example, more restrictive DRM, digital rights management, higher prices. In some cases, people want to charge higher prices for the digital download than for the physical DVD. And the argument is it's more convenient to buy it as a digital download than to buy, even though you don't get the DVD extras and you don't get the hard copy and everything else. I can understand that argument for not wanting their old model to change, or at least not wanting to endanger their old model. I do get the impression, though, that there's another way of looking at this, where the movie studios say, you know what? We've got many distribution options. We can distribute stuff through the box office. We can distribute it through movie rentals. We can distribute it through television, through cable television. We can distribute it through pay-per-view. We can distribute it through all these other online services that work in certain places. We eventually maybe can distribute it through cell phones. They say, you know what? We've got all of these different options. There are all these ways that we're making money right now. We're not in any hurry to do this because piracy and file sharing, the argument might go, is not cutting out that large a portion of our revenue. So right now, if people want the movie, they have to go, by and large, they're going to go to one of the legitimate ways of obtaining that movie. And so if they say, well, you know what, we're not really in danger of losing anything to this, let's just make sure that as it shakes out, as digital downloads fall into place, we make sure they fall into a place where we want them. Is there any legitimacy to that line, that way of viewing what's going on here?
Sure. And I'm sure those are all things that the studios have worked through in this whole process of getting to where they are now. And they may very well be right that they can just sit back and wait, and everyone else will finally succumb and come back to them and say, okay, we'll go for whatever deal you have. So that's a possibility. My gut feeling, though, is that the movie industries are going to find that they really do need to adapt to the new technology, the new distribution methods, because there's a lot of people that are able to go out and download movies right now without paying any fees. So they're stealing the content. And the services that are available today to let them download movies outside of the iTunes store aren't as good as they could be and aren't as easy to use as they ought to be. And I think ultimately that the studios are going to become a little bit more flexible so that they can get their content online where it's going to make them the most money. And I think that's going to be with Apple.
And this follows the argument where you say, you know what, maybe it's not exactly how we want it to work, but if we put it up there, hey, all of a sudden there's this whole new pile of money coming in.
Exactly.
Fair enough. And I guess that'll do it for this context machine. If you have questions or comments about the news, you can go ahead and send them to roundup@macobserver.com.
We spent all last show on the product roundup, so this week it'll be really quick. Ricky, tell us about your mic.
All right, so last week we talked about the Shure KSM-27, which is a condenser mic. It's a studio quality, it's really a pro-level mic, but it's at the very inexpensive end of pro-level mics, and I was actually really psyched using it. That cost around $300, if I remember correctly, off the top of my head. This is a mic that's more on the order of about $100 when you look at it at the online retailers. It's the Behringer B1 condenser microphone. And just to give people some idea of what's going on here, Behringer actually sent us a couple microphones that came here earlier this week. This is the B1. The current microphone that they sell is called the B2 Pro. And that's about $150, I think, when you look for it online. But it's a very similar thing. The B2 adds an option to be able to change the pattern, I'm pretty sure. This one, the B1, is a cardioid mic, just like all the other condenser microphones we've been looking at. So it's a really interesting little mic. Before I say anything else about it, Jeff, I'm kind of curious. I'm going to put you on the spot here. And no is a perfectly reasonable answer to this question. I'm curious if you hear any difference between this microphone and the one I was talking into last week.
No. Actually, no, I don't. They both sound equally good.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing. It's not obvious that one of these is better than the other, particularly for podcasting. And if you're looking for a condenser mic for podcasting, this is actually a really interesting choice. What I did before we started recording the show is I got this mic and the Shure KSM-27 and the Samson mic, and I recorded a little bit of me talking in front of the mic on each one. And at the end of the show, what I'll do is I'll tack on after the theme plays at the end, I'll tack on samples from those three things. And the fact is, there's not a huge amount of difference between them or among them. I would say, based on the price of this microphone relative to the other ones, and the fact that for all intents and purposes, for podcasting, this is a great microphone. It's a solid microphone. It gets the low end in my voice pretty well. It's got a nice clear sound at the top. It works. And it works really well. It sounds really clear. You don't need to explain to anyone, oh, I'm using this mic. It just works. It just sounds good. So of all the condensers that I've used so far, this seems to be, for most podcasters, to be the most appropriate thing. It's a nice, inexpensive microphone at $100. That's not bad at all. Behringer also makes, incidentally, something they call the C1, which is a $30 condenser microphone. And I think, actually, John Braun uses that at the Mac Geek Gab. If he doesn't use it now, he used it for many, many weeks earlier on. And he sounded fine on it. $30 condenser microphone, which is terrific. So this thing sounds great. And if you're looking for a condenser microphone, this is the first one where I've tried it and said, oh, yeah, that sounds good. And the price is not out of the range of most podcasters. And it is hard to get up here every week and say, well, you know, this is a really cool microphone. It costs $350, $500, whatever. It's hard to do that week after week, because I understand that most podcasters aren't looking for something that's in that price range. And this also, if you want to be able to record some instruments or some other things, this is a solid microphone for that. So it is a cool product, and of the things I've seen so far of the condensers, this is definitely fine. If you're curious, if you're looking for more subtle differences in microphones, take a listen to the clips at the end of the show, and you'll be able to hear some distinctions. I won't talk about them too much because I think most people won't be that fixated on it. But if you are curious about microphones and the differences that you can get in sound and what's the difference between a $100 and a $300 microphone, there is actually there's a material difference. But for purposes of a podcast where you cram it, you know, where you downcode it to 80 kilobits per second, it's not I think worth it for most podcasters. So that's my two cents.
Well, okay. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to Weekly Roundup.
Our content, as always, is written by the fine staff of the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. That's all I've got until next week, which will be an interesting show. Check out next week's show. It'll be fun.
Excellent. And stay subscribed.
Until next week, which will be a cool show. I'm not just saying, well, I could just be saying that, but I don't say it every week. So presumably, maybe you'll think, whatever. Until next week, we'll see you online. So this is going to be two different tests. Right now, I'm standing in front of the Shure KSM-27 microphone. And I'm directly in front of it, directly on axis, staring straight into the microphone, talking right into it. Got a little pop filter on it, and I'm about maybe 3 fingers away from the mic, so I'm really right up on it. So this is the Behringer B1 microphone, different microphone. Again, I am starting out directly on axis, about 3 fingers away. I noticed, I'm pretty sure that this mic is a little bit hotter than the last mic. That is, I have the gain turned to the same place, and I'm getting more signal. One final microphone I wanted to test, I'm at the same gain now as when I turned off the Behringer B1. This is the Samson CL8. Again, I'm about 3 fingers away, got the same pop screen on it. I'm borrowing the shock mount from the Behringer B1. I'm really close on the mic, and now I'm going to do a little bit of pitch testing. So right now I'm talking in the lower parts of my voice with about as much resonance as I can muster, at least with my voice raw from singing, like before. And now I'm talking pretty much in the top ends of my voice. There are other ways for me to talk, but most of those involve falsetto, and I'm not going to do that right now. And I'm going to talk right at the bottom of my range, the most resonant sound that I can get. And then I'm going to talk up near in the top of my voice so I can compare that as well. And that is the Behringer B1. And so that's that. This is the Samson CL8. I'm going to go ahead and move back up on it and do this little tone test. So again, this is the most resonant part of my voice. I'm right up on top of the microphone talking with a lot of bass in my voice. And then when I talk up here, it should sound rather different. So this is all something to consider. This is the Samson CL8 directly on axis. I'm Ricky Spiro. Goodbye.